listeners, and welcome to another episode of Compare and Campaign. I am your host, as always, Tom Lando, and with me, as always, is my co-host and co-GM,
Miguel.
It is...
No fancy monikers this time. No fancy titles.
Nah, I got down right to the point. It is episode 157, recorded today on the 18th of July, 2023. Miguel, we've... Well, what have we got to do today? We just got the same old... I've got... Tales of, you know, my players in Dungeons and Dragons, they had just begun initiating their plans for an assassination of the villainous human supremacist leader, Lord Dio. Probably gonna see
That's right, and they were, like, right in the bedroom with him, weren't they?
Yeah, we're probably gonna see how that pops off real soon, because they basically... All their targets are in one place. They've got everything they need, from the gem sample to Dexter to Lord Dio. They're all in this big tent they've just found. And so it's just a matter of time. Connor's back in his sniper position, his little sniper's nest. And yeah, Hex and Gent have they're invisible, and they've cut their way right into the main tent.
Exciting. Did I remark before? I don't know if I actually did remark upon this last episode, but just the whole scene with them, like, sneaking around while Dio's asleep and the assassination attempt that's about to occur reminded me a lot of the start of the Greyhawk campaign that I talked about, where Maeve the Paladin broke into the sleeping quarters of the barbarian lord on his ship and was planning on assassinating him.
Yeah, but that one didn't turn out so well, whereas this one, well, hopefully it'll turn out great.
I was going to say, I don't know how this is going to turn out, but the setup, I was definitely having flashbacks to that tense moment stocking up on the sleeping target.
Meanwhile, since you don't have any campaign to talk about, I think, as I understand it, you're bringing some Palladium nonsense to the RPG Danger Room or maybe it's just the tavern. I don't know.
I guess this is the tavern, because I'm not covering a new RPG, of course. After a long break, we're going back to the Palladium Well to look at some silly things from the Rifts RPG, which we both have a long history with, and both a fondness for it, and yet we also think it's absolutely ridiculous. And, you know, we've been doing a lot of sort of a lot of very florid RPGs in the Danger Room for a while. I'm thinking, of course, of the two we did by Jenna Moran, Wisher, Thayer, Just Fatalist, and Nobilis as well. And we want to do that one that you were talking about. Is it plural? Is it the gates?
Yeah, the gates.
Yeah, the gates. We're going to get into that one as well, but it sounds like that one is also going to be sort of along those same lines with very sort of poetic language used. So before we do that, let's do something really dumb and silly. Let's talk about rifts again.
I'm down for it, man. Yeah, all right, so, shall we just kick off with my side of things, get back to that assassination?
Let's do it. What was the name of this operation?
This is Operation GoldenEye. How could you forget? Right.
No, I was just prompting you, my friend.
Yes. All right.
Yeah, The flower, the satellite, the cottage, and the James Bond movie, GoldenEye.
Yeah.
Oh, and the N64 game, of course.
Of course. How could we forget? So, Connor's in his sniper's nest, as I mentioned. He's got Overwatch on the whole thing, while Hex and Gent are down at the main tent where they've discovered that their target is sleeping. One of their targets, the target that they want to assassinate, is sleeping. The target they want to capture is awake and having a conversation at a table that also has samples of a gemstone that they're supposed to be grabbing. So like I said, all their objectives are in one place at this point. It's just that they're invisible and they have yet to, you know, make their move. So there's a whole bunch of documents on the table as well, which seem to indicate that the meeting will be with a delegation representing the Nightside Eclipse. Lord Dio sleeps a room away and a stranger sleeps in the chamber across from him. A stranger that we have tentatively named Oak, because based on certain documents that I believe were found on the table, seem to indicate like there were a number of names and they recognized all of them except for they were able to identify everybody but Oak. There was Lord Dio, there's Dexter. Dexter's talking to someone named Ray, and there's someone else sleeping in the room across for, or like the tent section across from Dio's, and apparently there's someone here named Oak, so they figure that that's Oak. Also, worth mentioning that Gent planted a caustic smoke trap in the chest in Dio's room.
Kind of like the idea of doing an assassination attempt, not by killing the person in their sleep, but by sneaking in and then just setting up a whole lot of deadly Home Alone booby traps so that they walk through them when they wake up.
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting way to do things. I mean, that's not what happens here. I mean, I can say that Alex is like right in the deliberation, like, yeah, it really seems like go time. Think you could take out Dio quietly, then we bum rush the others with the grenade. And I say the two of you can easily slip out of the tent, meet up outside, and converse while remaining invisible. So they can do that. Without, you know, last time we were having the goofy thing of they tried to do charades, and then I'm like, wait a minute, you're invisible. You can't do invisible charades. And then there was the thing about Gent has blind sense, so can you do invisible charades using echolocation or something? So, they both basically vote that they want to take out Dio now. And Alex figures that while they can't immediately contact Connor, I mean, he says that, but I don't think that's true. I think he could have, yeah, he can use the sending stones that remind him. So Alex is thinking, like, Connor, maybe if he notices a disturbance at the camp, he activates the animal version, earlier referred to as Operation African Lion Safari. Gent is also thinking that they want to actually take their trap that they planted in the chest and redeploy that at the stable so as to make a big old distraction. And Hex sends to Connor to be ready for a quick getaway. And then tells him that the plans have moved forward a night. And so he, you know, begins marking targets sort of Ghost Recon style for sniping once things pop off. Gent is like, all right, so step one, we're going to plant the grenade. Step two, we're going to kill Dio. Step three, we're going to deal with Dex and the stones. What do we do about sleeping Oak? And Hex tells Connor to cover their exit from Dio's tent, and he says, I can deal with Oak while you do Dio, and then we meet in the middle. And then Jen is like, all right, so I'm going to basically, instead of having the trap set so that it's like whoever opens the chest, Gent redeploys or resets the grenade so that it's a trap that like will go off on a fuse basically, so it'll go off on its own, and basically sets it to give them enough time so that they can deal with the people in the big tent. We established that Connor is in his sniper's position with the anti-material rifle, the Orion, and Jen returns to Dio's room, disarms the trap, takes the bomb, switched it to a time fuse, which takes and then the fuse is like 1 to 6 rounds. It's up to them.
Just like going in and out, adjusting. Oh, okay, wait, no, it's gotta be a timed one instead.
I mean, really, it's just like they planted the trap and then they're like, oh, never mind. And they go in, take the trap out, like disarm it, go out, and then they're like, all right, now it's time to turn it into a bomb. And I mean, they have to roll stealth with advantage because they're invincible. They got a 33, so, you know, Dio doesn't wake up. Meanwhile, Hex is just keeping hidden as best he can, so I have him roll stealth with advantage. Gent has no difficulty disarming their own trap and are easily able to retrieve the bomb. So at this point, Gent goes to the stable to replant the bomb. And again, I have Gent give stealth with advantage, and they get a 35. Hex gets a 22 with his stealth with advantage. I get another one from Gent, and they get a 33. And I say, it's tense planting the bomb. The horses are fitful and their caretakers move around a lot. A few times you think that a dog may have sniffed you out, or you may have made a sound audible to the handlers or guards. But by the end, you manage to set the bomb to your liking without difficulty. And I ask what they're setting the bomb for, and they say, I think 4 rounds, 1 to travel, 1 to kill, 1 to regroup with Hex, and 1 to attack Dio intent. And I want to double check I'm accurate with that time. I mean, 1 to kill Dio, 1 to regroup, 1 to attack Dex intent. And Alex is like, sounds good to me. And I say, they'll probably want to go with the full 6 rounds, as it may take a couple to get from the stable to the Lord's tent. She's like, all right, this sounds good. So,
1 for the money, 2 for the show, 3 to get Dio, 4 to go.
I feel like it should end on get Dio. If it's
no, true, true.
So they return to the tent. Hex is invisible in position outside the cut leading into Oak's room. And Gent is 2 rounds have passed, and Gent is like, okay, I will go into Dio's room and stab him. And Alex says, I'll duck into Oak's tent and do the same. And I say, in order to keep quiet and maintain stealth, it will actually take Jen another round just to reach Dio without running. But I have Hex give an attack roll with advantage, and same with Jen. So this is a whole thing about, like, attacking, like, a sleeping or incapacitated target. Or, like, this is one of the things that makes whole person so good, because paralyze has this like crazy effect. It's the thing of like, you not only get advantage to attack, but if you hit in melee, it's an automatic critical. Do you know that rule?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
it's classic. So they're just get like super.
Honestly, this whole operation, like getting in here, was pretty complicated. But the actual assassination, it feels like the team here. It's like this is a walk in the park for these guys. I'm just gonna go in and stab them while they sleep.
Yeah, I mean that's part of it. They've got a bit more to do in the mission, though. Gent uses their vile, vicious life-stealing rapier of wounding, the one that they got in Citra Akra. It's like a... I always describe this rapier as, like, the blade is almost like a twitching proboscis that's, like, looking to drain the life out of people. And so with the critical, they do... With the automatic critical, they do an extra 10 necrotic damage and steal life from Dio, which is pretty awesome. Meanwhile, Hex gets a 31 for his first attack, and he's like, oh, just 14 damage. And, yeah, I go through the whole, thing with Jen. I'm like, so the rapier, it's +12 to attack, It's an auto crit, so they do 2d8 plus 6 pierce, an additional 20 necrotic damage, 14 piercing from vicious weapon, and the sword of wounding makes the target take 1d4 damage per round until they save. And,
Okay, wait, do you have the total? What's the total damage?
It sort of comes in pieces. Okay, so basically, first of all, Hex is like, damn, I rolled terribly. He gets a 14 even with the crit. Gent rolls a 17, which I think luckily hits. But they're like, if that hits, I rolled 18 pierce. And also, Hex was using the Crucifix Scimitar, but it wasn't lit up. So it's a scimitar that can catch fire, but wasn't in this case. And I'm like, also don't forget, Gent, the 18d6 sneak that they have to this attack. So they rolled 18 piercing damage and 62 sneak attack. And I pointed out actually that I realized that the necrotic and vicious damage early I doubled when I shouldn't have. So actually it ends up coming out to a total of 97 damage, to answer your question.
97.
Alex or Hex does all his damage in magic slashing, and I'm like, okay. So, Gent, you slip your rapier deep into Lord Dio silently. His eyes open, and he stares at you in horror, gurgling blood in an alarmed tone. He's not dead, but he's damn close. And Gent says, damn it, so close. I stab again. And I say, Hex, you bring the blade down on Oak, but they turn over in their sleep just as the magic weapon falls on them. You slice through the fur blankets easily, but find you have only lightly cut your prey. Oak turns over, eyes wide, and everyone rolls initiative. Gent gets an extra turn because they have surprise. And they get to make their attack with advantage, and I point out if they hit, there's no way they don't kill Dio. And with the 29 to hit, I say, you push the blade further, and the Lord of the Mantle exhales his last on a tide of blood. And meanwhile, I have Hex makes a wisdom saving throw, and he gets nat 20, and Oak looks up into his eyes, and he feels a familiar sensation. It is the feeling he's felt recently when demons have attempted to influence his mind. He shakes it off, and Oak's eyes go wide with terror, as is more befitting of a man attacked in bed while undressed and unarmed. Oak struggles to get out of bed, yelping, "Intruders in the Lord's tent!" Hex is allowed an attack of opportunity as he gets out of bed. Gent, as you assassinate Lord Dio, you hear the exclamations of Oak from the next chamber over. And, So I allow Hex to pull his Apollo laser pistol, and as the man stumbles out of bed, Hex blasts him square in the back. He takes 12 radiant damage. Oak stumbles into Dio's chamber just in time to see Gent standing over the Lord's body. And Gent says, nice, he came to see me. Would he see me? And I say, yes, Oak would see Gent. And I say, you can hear chaos breaking out now. Ray, the scout in the main area, calls to the guards out front, but a commotion starts coming from the distance. The bomb seems to be going off. And then Alex says, wait, did Gent just kill a whole bunch of puppies? I don't think we thought this through. And I said, no, the stable, not the kennels. And we jump back to Gent, and they move to attack Oak, using their rapier as well. And, I mean, it's this, there's this thing where I'm like, what weapon? And they're like, the rapier still. Figured I couldn't switch. I mean, they're all rapiers. And I say, nah, Sunblade is a katana. Basically a lightsaber. They roll a 1 on damage, so they get a 30 to hit Oak, but they only do 7 piercing damage. And I say, well, you cut the fancy pajama boy, much to his displeasure, having only just entered the room. He cries out in pain. Ah, they've killed Lord Dio! And Dexter comes rushing up behind Oak, a look of shock and disbelief on his face. "It cannot be! Dio!" he calls out as if to address the dead lord. Behind him in Oak's room, it is Hex's turn. Hex rages and then shoots Oak in the back. Vengeful spirits swirl out of the forest to accompany Hex as he shoots Oak. Dexter ducks with a frightened yelp as the two laser blasts strike Oak in the back of the head. He's still up, though. As another blast strikes him, Oak staggers forward, and then Hex moves up, pulls out the Cube of Force, and smashes the 5 button, and now they are locked in here with Hex. This is the classic. Hex has this, like, cube that he can deploy that traps people in a force field. And now his force field deploys so that... It deploys so that him, Hex, Gent, Oak, and Dexter are all in a cube together. So now it's basically a cage match in the tent. So... it gets over to being Connor's turn, and he's in his sniper's position. I say there's quite a lot to see across the camp from his vantage point. Smoke appears to be spilling out of the stables, while many guards, militiamen, and drones have flocked to the site. The alarm braziers have sent up great gouts of flame on 4 sides of the camp. A trail of lizard spirits converges on Dio's tent like a twister pulling from the enchantments of the forest. 3 militiamen are heading for Dio's tent, but otherwise there's no aid on its way. The most obvious target is one of the militiamen still positioned at the tent's entrance. So Connor takes that shot, gets 22 to hit. I'm like, got him. And, so does, 33 damage. And I say you basically blow one of this guy's legs out from under him, and a scream of pain echoes across the camp. And then, the militiamen outside the tent come rushing in, one of them hopping and bleeding heavily from his new stump leg. The militiamen all reach the edge of the cube of force and find themselves confounded by it as it completely blocks their way into the corridor. Connor can spot the reinforcements at the entrance now, but the chaos in the camp means that only the 3 militiamen that could be alerted by the ones posted at the tent's entrance initially arrive. Ray, the scout captain, throws himself at the cube of force in vain. Surrounded in the cube, Oak enters his true form, that of an incubus, similar to the other fiends that they've encountered recently, such as the ones at the masquerade in the mantle. And I get them to roll insight, and Gent gets a nat 20. I say, evidently, the mantle's leadership has some kind of issue with fiendish infiltration, because this is at least the second time you've seen this sort of thing happen. You also recall the demon that you fought when dealing with the night goblins when you first came to Agalloch. Something is obviously drawing infernal attention to the mantle and its politics. And blood trickles from a particularly deep incision made in the demon's true form by the cruel rapier in Gent's hands. And it is Gent's turn once again. Gent attacks Oak again. They get a 25 to hit, but then once again roll a 1 on damage for 7 total. And I point out, just like, because I'm sort of doing some revelations now in terms of intelligence, is like, just to remind them as players, I say, this is their 5th op in Agalloch, and it's the 4th to feature fiends in one form or another. A fiend was among the night goblins, demons were with the goblins attacking the Myconids, a fiend was spotted after the masquerade, and now this. And, Gent is like, obviously I should know something about, but I really don't. And Hex just says, bad things from far away. And I say, it's just a very noticeable pattern at this point. Then, even though they only got the 7 for the damage, Gent rolls 24 for sneak attack damage. And they're like, bonus action, I think I have the bindings we were going to use against Dexter, so I want to throw them to Hex. But then I say, Gent drives her blade straight through the fiend's heart, slaying it instantly. And then I point out that they have two magic restraints at least, the bands of binding or entangling rope, and each one can literally just be thrown at Dexter to activate. And Gent has the ability Fast Hands as a high-level thief, so I allow them to use either one as like a function of Fast Hands. So, Gent throws the entangling rope at Dexter. Unfortunately, Dexter dodges the rope just barely. He basically has to fall into one side of the cube, as there's so little space for him to escape from it. But escape he does, for now. Dexter draws a katana, then he tries to swing at Hex, but misses with embarrassing inaccuracy. However, in a desperate spinning strike, the Spymaster manages to cut the Lizardman.
Oh my gosh.
He deals 9 slashing, but 4 after reduction because he's raging. The katana lightly grazes Hex's scaly right leg. Dexter then enters a defensive stance, though it looks more like he's cowering behind his blade. Appropriate, as it is Hex's turn now. And Hex points to the demon on the floor and shouts, "Look at it, Dexter! Look at the purity of Agalok! This is for your own good!" And then he tosses the iron Pokeball at him, aka the Bands of Bellaro, ball of iron bands. So he throws the ball of iron bands out and expands to envelop him, and that is it. Dexter is restrained. Hex says, "Get ready to run like hell." It's Connor's turn, so Connor starts heading toward the camp, and he activates the golden lions as part of, Operation Lion Safari, Operation African Lion Safari, to start that big old distraction. He's going to turn a couple of lion figurines into 2 actual lions that are going to help him attack the camp.
And remember, folks, if you're going to African Lion Safari, do not use your own car when you drive through.
Yeah, definitely don't do it. You'll
get covered in monkey poop.
Yeah, it's a bad scene. yeah, there's something I don't quite understand here. So, it's just Hex says something about, "This is that frozen chest all over again," he mutters, which is referencing the chest with the puzzle in the other place, but like, I don't know. Honestly, I feel like we should cut that because I don't know what it's about. Oh well. So Connor gets up from his sniper position, starts heading down the hill, summons a couple of lions, then gets on the back of one of them, and the lions take him within sprinting distance of the tent. So he now appears on the map, and the militiamen pour into the corridor behind the cube's force field, flailing at Gent in vain with the cube's power between them and their target. And at this point, Gent is like, "I'm not even sure we should get the gems." And Ray attempts to get around the cube, not fully understanding its power. He's unable to strike at them, but he does position himself in a manner that is highly annoying for Hex's movement due to the cube. However, the cube can be made to accept walls. You know these walls are quite fragile. And Gent is like, "Wait, cube can be made to accept walls?" And so basically the thing is, this force field that the cube is projecting, as long as Hex is carrying it around, he can like move it around with them, so they can be in the force field and like move around. And also what I mean by like it can be made to accept walls is that like the force field can like keep living things out while still allowing like the walls of the tent to pass through. Do you know what I mean?
I think so.
Basically, the force field is not like something that gets stuck in the tent. It's just something that's keeping out any enemies. But the thing to note here is that what's happened is that a bunch of the militiamen are attacking the cube from one side, and then Ray has come around to the other side of the cube, so that Hex can't really, like, there's people on either side, so either direction that he tries to move in, the force field ends up like bumping up against people, which it can't move through.
Gotcha. So it's radiated out from him?
Yes.
So he can just, like, plow his way through a crowd with it?
Sort of. The crowd is currently sort of holding him in. But what I point out is that basically, because they are able to just, like, get the tent into the force field and then they can cut through the tent, really, they can just, like, push through a wall. Right? They can just, like, move into the wall, slash through it, and then move through with the force field.
Okay, yeah.
So I point that out, and Gent says, okay, I vote we do that. When the cube comes down, you head out with Dexter. I can attempt to sneak back in to grab the gems and meet you. And meanwhile, Connor is on his lions with the cavalry down south. And Hex says, do you have a way of getting out on your own? And Gent just says, sneak. And Hex says, Godspeed, little blackbird. And I say, the iron bands rumble as if something tremendous, as if some tremendous might is being put into breaking free from within. But at last, the sphere settles. And Gent says, stay the fuck in there, Pikachu! Which is a classic Pokemon reference of, like, the Pokeball rumbling and, like, not being sure if the Pokemon's going to stay in it. So they move east to cut through the tent, and Hex uses his bonus action to light up his scimitar and takes a slash at it, adding some exciting side effects to the situation. Hex tears through the heavy canvas with ease, pushing through a blazing maw in the side of the tent as he escapes. Smoke fills the air above the camp. Connor is approaching on the back of a lion, another lion following beside him. Guards cry out from the walls, but their voices are lost in the commotion that is spread throughout the camp. Gent is at Hex's back within the cube. And I say, at this point, you could actually swing around the tent so that you block Ray and the militia in while still allowing you to move to the other side of the Lord's tent where you could cut through and grab the gems. So basically, it's this wild thing of, like, they just, like, basically they using a flaming sword, they tear out one side of the tent. They've got their force field around them, and then I point out that they can basically, like, double back in their force field, run around the people who are chasing them, cut back into the tent, into the area where the gems are, go over, get the gems, like, within the force field, grab them, and then make their escape, and that's what they decide to do. The militia are now mobbed at the point where they made their exit, suddenly caught in a burning building. The fire spreading from the gash in the tent lingers dangerously close to the wooden tent pole in the corner of Geo's room. Connor and the lions arrive just as they wind around the tent. At this point, Connor and the lions could actually probably tear through the tent wall and Connor could grab the gems. He rides up and Gent and Hex are just pointing and yelling, gems in the tent! The lions rip through the side of the tent and Connor hops off the one he's riding just to rush over, snatch up the gems, and then return to his mount. Guards are now converging on the Lord's tent from all directions. Cries for help can be heard from Dio's room. Gent says, so many pockets that won't be picked. Ray slices his own exit and springs out of the tent just between the cube and Connor and his lions.
The lions, the entrance with the lions, has me thinking of the movie RRR.
Oh, yeah, classic.
Chaotic battle scene with all the zoo animals.
Yeah.
In fact, the power level of your player characters does have a certain Bollywood quality to it.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. They are, like, very, it is very equipment-based, you know? I don't know. Like, is there any, like, movie or, like, I guess there's certain, like, kung fu that is very, like, sword-based, you know, like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon sort of thing. I'm just thinking of, like, sort of the, like, the movie equivalent of, like, Soul Calibur, you know, where, like, it's the emphasis is really on, like, the weapons.
You mean like a Bollywood movie like that?
Or just like any sort of genre that fits that description.
Oh yeah, well, those, I can never think of how to pronounce it. Is it Wuxia or
Yeah, I
Wuxia?
think you're right. Like,
Wuxia?
that's
They
what I
tend to
was thinking,
have
yeah.
a lot of stories where it's like a magic sword that gives the wielder superpowers.
Gent says this is when the video game does a cutscene. I say it's Gent's turn. If Hex wants to drop the cube, they could all attempt to attack Bray before moving to escape on the Lions. And I say also, Connor and the Lions could close the distance, so it'd be like everyone attacks Ray, then you guys mount up and dip. But then Gent says, "Am I attuned to that weird whip that I picked up from the Mind Flayer guy?" I don't think I am. Irrelevant question. I will change to the fire rapier and then hold my action to attack when the cube comes down. And I say the issue is that you never identified the tentacle flail. And they're like, right, homework. Probably not the best time to try out a new weapon anyway. Do you ever had that situation where like a character in a dramatic moment is like, wait a minute, and now I pull out that weird weapon that I've never used?
All the time.
Classic.
It's not necessarily like the weird weapon, but it happens very frequently, especially in like a big ongoing combat that my players will be like, wait a second. And they'll like look at their equipment list, you know, their backpack of loot that they've just been stuffing in there and not paying attention to. And inevitably someone's like, wait a minute, I have this, you know, potion of what's it? I'm gonna use that.
Gent, basically what happens is when the Hex has to use his action to drop the cube of force, so he deactivates the cube, but then as soon as that happens, Gent's action goes off to sneak attack Ray with the benefit of Gent or Hex being there for the sneak attack. And I say, your flaming rapier perforates the scout captain from head to toe. And Jet says, fast hands to pick his pockets. And I say, Connor and his lions come over to pick you up. It seems like your getaway requires that you not linger. And Jet begrudgingly jumps on the lion. And Connor says, you have enough marbles. Let's go, please. And Jet says, just by saying that, you prove you cannot possibly understand. And as they make their escape on lion back, militiamen pour out of the tent, cut in the tent behind them. Some attempt to cast nets at them, but they are able to cut them away where they do not fall short behind them. A hail of sharp stones comes down on them as they make their escape into the forest. Everyone takes 23 piercing damage. Lions are badly hurt by this barrage, but it doesn't stop them getting the party away to safety. They all get 2,300 XP for a new total of 278,875 XP. After escaping into the forest, the lions return to their figurine form. Their lion form lasts for an hour. It's early morning and they are exhausted by the time they reach the Draelic lines. But they all get a chance to examine the gems on their way back through the forest, and they get an arcana check. So, with their arcana checks, unfortunately, none of them make anything of the stones. Even Gent's cursory geological studies provide no insight. They return to the Draelic encampment where they last left their vehicles. Immediately upon arrival, they find that the construction of the defenses has been completed, and the palisades facing the forest now stretch from one manned watchtower to another. They are watched carefully by Draelic gunners from a distance. When they approach, they call back into the encampment. A small handful of soldiers rush out and greet the group with salutes as they enter the camp. And then they see Sir Ram approaching from the office in the center of the area. And Gent says, how many stones are there? And Alex says, correction, how many stones are there before Gent looks at them? And I say, there is one main stone and four smaller samples, basically one stone, four pebbles. And Gent says, I think we should keep a pebble at least. And Sir Ram comes forward and says, well, that was quick. Does that mean good news or bad? And Hex says, mostly good, a little loud. And Gent says, bloody good. He says, so, Dio and the Spy Master? And Hex says, dead and right here. And he tosses up the ball and catches it. And Ram catches the ball and his face slowly lights up. You hear that, lads? They put out one of the snake eyes for us. The other one's in our hands now, Sir Ram calls to the soldiers, who cheer and sing their praises. Safe to tell you now, Ram says, leading in, but this means we'll be launching the Draelic invasion of Agaloc immediately. Best to catch them while their heads are off, eh? He gives Hex a pat on the back. To that end, I felt you should have this, in case you need backup in the future. And he provided Hex with a silver horn. He explained that it is a silver horn of Valhalla, and when blown, it will call the spirits of mighty warriors to their aid.
Badass.
Yeah.
Spirits of mighty warriors and lions.
Hell yeah.
And probably got more things they can just call in. Now I'm going to be waiting for like a battle scene where instead of the party wading into battle, they just sit back and just radio in every different bit of backup they can get. Let's get our, you know, spirit guardians in there, and then we'll also get the Valhalla warriors and some lions.
I mean, they could have definitely used that tactic the time that they had to capture the two fire giants, and they had to fight, like, just tons and tons and tons of dudes. There's a whole discussion about who gets the silver horn of Valhalla, and Alex says, maybe this is your Nat 1 insurance. Like, sneak attack goes bad and the Lost Vikings pop out. And Gent takes the horn and says, took jazz class in college. And Alex says, French horn of Valhalla. And I say, after congratulating you again, Ram says, by the way, the tiefling has been eagerly awaiting your return inside. He gestures toward the cartography office. Hex says, okay, of course, right, we should go. And, they find Rin huddled up next to the fireplace in the cartography office. Cold weather here clearly does not agree with her. She hurries over to them upon spotting them, eager to conclude her business here. Any luck, she asks, hopefully. And Gent says, what were they for again? She says, that's what I'm trying to figure out. The people in Agaloc were collecting it, and we don't know anything about it. Hopefully I can use the research to aid somehow if we get into trouble with them. And Gent hands over the stones minus a pebble. And Hex actually says in brackets, two? Al might want to see those. And so Gent says, okay, actually minus two. One big, two small. And Rin says, perfect. She says, primarily focusing on the larger stone. Excellent, thank you. I mean, I'm sure you'll have the gratitude of the army if this turns out to be important, but she looks through a satchel at her side. I only really have supplies to offer, but I imagine you could always use some. She effectively offers one free med kit with 10 charges. And Hex says, got any family recipes? And she smiles and says, nothing particularly useful, at least compared to the stuff in here. She nods to the med kit. But I know how to mix up some tiefling sauces in a pinch, if you'd like to know about those. And Hex denotes them in a journal. And Gent grabs the free med kit, giving Gent effectively 18 charges of medkit, because they've still got 8 charges on their existing medkit. Gent says, giver of life, picker of pockets. And as they return to Omega Base in their vehicles, we conclude Operation Goldeneye. Next time, Operation Falling Moon, the beginning of the liberation of Agaloc.
Over the course of these three campaigns, the three Empok-centric campaigns, do you have a sense of what percentage of the world map, the Drail map, has been liberated by your players?
Oh yeah, like, well, hold on, that by my players specifically or just in general? Because like, the narrative of the liberation of the Deathlands is like pretty coherent. Like, I can say for sure that it like, it starts in the first campaign, or like really it starts in the second campaign. The first campaign is like, you know, their first frontier ops where they sort of get a good look at behind enemy lines. But yeah, like Agaloc is the last place in Drail that needs to be liberated.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah, this is the big, this is the big final one.
So does that mean, like, I know we've been talking about how your campaign notes are catching up to the present. Like, you're getting closer and closer to the adventures you are currently running, right?
Yeah.
But I don't think we've talked about, like, if this is the last thing to be that needs to be liberated, does that mean that this campaign itself is also coming to a close?
Sort of. There is more to happen beyond the liberation of the Deathlands.
Okay.
I'll say that.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I could say, spoiler alert, but the final act that comes after the liberation of the of Agaloc, sees them return to Citra Akra. And that is a whole sort of, it's like Act 3 or, yeah, I think it was Act 3 they were in Citra Akra. And then like Act 3 is basically mirrored by Act 6, wherein they return to, like, they remember they did that whole tour of Citra Akra where they did each, like, place in it. They're going to have to go back and, like, visit each place again, basically, in the last act.
Oh, that'll be cool.
Yeah, it's a big, big, like, see what you hath wrought sort of thing. The real thing was,
exactly. I like the idea of going back and doing a before and after. And it's funny, it never actually occurs to me to do that. And so many of my campaigns are like these road trips. I really should pull that more often.
The really funny thing was that the real takeaway from their last trip to Citra Akra was when they pulled that forgery job, like that forgery scam in the place called Larve, and they left, and Hex was like, "We can't ever go back to Larve," but they're they're gonna have to go back to Larve. And I kept telling them, and I was so happy. I was like, "It looks like you're gonna have to go back to Larve," and they're like, "No."
No, we can't. We can't. We can never go back.
So we wrap up with Gent like squaring away some agenda items. They're like, okay, I'm gonna send the college one of those purple pebbles, and I want to look at that rod some more. And then Connor or Alex really is like, oh shit, whoops, loose ends. That poor Insomnium addict. He's going to be so confused. And Chantel says, yeah, just a man with a dead bunny bomb. He says, and the belief that he's being haunted by drug dealer demons and a bottle of poison. I say, well, on the plus side, it seems that drug dealer demons might not be uncommon in the mantle at this point. And he says, yeah, I'm a little worried about what's actually inside the iron bands. And Gent says, oh, we got rid of a poison. Oh, well, it was a good plan. Alex says, yeah, apparently we were just way overthinking it. Just need to ride lions off into the sunset. I say, to be fair, it was a very close escape. One round off and the militia would have been able to take out the lions before they got away. Gent said, while I like stealth and all, I struggle with when to pull the trigger. And Alex says, that situation in the tent was too good to pass up. Too bad my damage roll was trash. And Chantel said, I'm most impressed by our resident sniper amputating a guard. And I say, actually, Hex got very lucky with his wisdom save. Very glad he did not get charmed by a fiend mid-assassination. And that was the end of the session. Actually, the last notes here are Alex says, yeah, the Orion rifle seems good. Gotta put Connor on Overwatch more often. I literally played a session last night where the barbarian slash fighter got dominated. It was awful. And finally, Chantel just says, I should make more bombs. And that was the last thing anybody said before the next, like, communication.
Well, I gotta say, more than that session, like, I'm now very excited to hear all the stuff you have foreshadowed.
Man, yeah, well, there's lots of stuff to come, let me tell you. I also, I think I had said that the operation was called Falling Moon, but then I corrected the operation is actually called Failing Moon, not Falling Moon. And then Chantel just shared a picture of the crazy moon from Majora's Mask, and I was like, yeah, pretty much.
Hey, that crazy moon from Majora's Mask might be a Mimic Moon.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good way to do it.
It's got a big face.
So that's my side of things, unless you've got any other questions or comments about how that assassination finally went off.
I mean, my comments, like I said, reminded me of Bollywood, of a scene like the attack with all the zoo animals from RRR, and I don't know, it just seemed like a whole lot of the expected pandemonium from this party. They're so powerful that even when made me think of the way I play like stealth video games, where like I'm sneaking in, being really careful not to get noticed, setting up my careful plan. Oh, okay, never mind, it's all off. Let's just kill everybody then. Mm-hmm. All right, let's go over to the tavern and say hi to our old buddies in Rifts. Our old friend, Kevin Simbida. Simbida?
Seems like it's been a while since we've been in the tavern.
It has. It's been a long time since we talked about Rifts last, because, I mean, we've talked about it a lot in the past on this podcast, and because it's so familiar to us, it's not really RPG Danger Room material. We know this one. So when I decided I wanted to talk more about Rifts, I was like, what should I talk about? And so I started doing some of my Googling, and I Googled, what's the worst character class in Rifts? I came up with a lot of results. Across the board, everybody seems to agree that occupational character classes are stupid in general. That everyone says, like, do a racial character class, and then all the stuff you'd get from an occupational character class, you can sort of work your way into that stuff, but you're starting with the RCC Foundation. Well, this is what a lot of the forum folks are saying, and also forum folks are talking about, you know, there are varied choices for the worst character classes, but there was one that kept popping up on the majority of people's lists, and it surprised me, Tom, because it's actually a pretty popular, at least I think it's pretty popular, Rifts OCC. Do you care to guess what a lot of people were saying is just the worst OCC in Rifts?
So it's a core one, I guess?
Yeah.
Mech Doc?
I mean, I wouldn't say you're too far off. It's the Glitter Boy.
Oh, Glitter Boy, that's OCC. Definitely, that's actually quite far off, but I wondered if it was the Glitter Boy.
Yeah, Glitter Boy, and it's probably for all the reasons you can imagine, right?
You need your Glitter Boy to be functional.
Yeah, it's all predicated upon one very specific type of power armor, and not just one specific type of power armor, but like Glitter Boys are kind of antiques. Like they originate before the Great Cataclysm. They have this very long sort of history as being this relic, right? The Glitter Boys are kind of these relics of the past in the Rift's timeline. And everybody's saying, like, pilot a better mech. But I just thought it was surprising in my mind, Glitter Boys are the symbol of Rifts.
Yeah, I mean, there's a Glitter Boy on the front of Rift's Chaos Earth, which really should tell you where things are headed with Rift's Chaos Earth. It's supposed to be like a big, like, apocalyptic game, and then it's like, oh, but you can play Glitter Boy, so it's not all that apocalyptic, is it? I mean, I guess.
Glitter boys are completely redundant and reductive OCCs, presenting a greater overall problem with OCC bloat. All a glitter boy provides is another power armor pilot OCC.
Doesn't sound.
Robot pilot OCC. We don't need a specialized class for each type of armor or robot, especially with so little difference between the classes.
I don't know. That sounds like it flies in the face of the very mentality of Rifts. The idea that you don't need an individual OCC for every type of robot thing. It's like, man, we've got an individual book for every place in the planet.
So this is actually a topic that I was hoping would lead into with discussion of glitter boys and how there's all this talk here. Like this guy says, better to have a pilot class with subclasses than just, you know, the specialized glitter boy pilot. And this got me to thinking about the different types of RPGs that we've just been discussing. And in my mind, the more systems we talk about, the more I find them sort of falling into these different categories. You know, like there are very Dungeons and Dragons-esque RPG systems. We think of things like Essence 20. There are then systems that are sort of similar to something like Blades in the Dark. I think of like City of Mist as being kind of the same type of RPG system, even if it's not exactly like one-to-one in terms of how the rules work.
Powered by the Apocalypse covers like a large swath of like popular RPGs right now.
Exactly. And then I got to Rifts and I was thinking like, what is the appeal of Rifts in relation to these other RPG systems? Like, I feel like, can you think of other RPG systems that are sort of comparable to the Palladium ones in the same way as like D20 systems, or I'm not sure. Is there a name even for the category of things like Blades in the Dark? Is it just like Forged in the Dark systems? Or
yeah, I mean, so if it's based on Blades in the Dark, it's a Forged in the Dark system. But Blades in the Dark, I think, like, is also kind of a... There is some claimed lineage of, like, Powered by the Apocalypse leading to Blades in the Dark. So I think...
Yeah, but like, What's the umbrella term for both of those systems, though? You know, just like how the umbrella term for something like D&D and Essence 20 is like a D20 RPG. Is there an umbrella term for the Blades in the Dark Powered by the Apocalypse style?
I think Powered by the Apocalypse is like the closest you're going to get there.
All right, so Powered by the Apocalypse... Where does Palladium fit into this? Is it just its own style, or can you think of other RPG systems separate from the Palladium ones that feel similar?
There are older games. There's an old Middle Earth game specifically that I'm thinking of. It's tough because they're all sort of old retro games, and they're not games that I like would play, but I've seen. But the thing that they all have in common is like the percentile roll. The idea that everything, that your stats are measured out of a 100 out of like 100%. Like, that is the thing I think Rifts has in common with a lot of other games that go for a similar kind of like maximalist kind of mechanic. I wonder even if Traveler is a percentile game like that.
Maybe I'll have to cover Traveler on a future RPG Danger Room, so we can get a solid answer on it. But that's a good identifier. You know, we can say it's the D100 system or the percentile system. And so in thinking of those categories that are becoming apparent as we explore different games, that in turn made me think, like, what is the appeal of each? I feel like D&D sort of strikes the most appealing balance for a lot of people, where there's enough dice rolling and customization that you can get kind of crunchy. You can play around with the rules. You can, you know, find interesting interactions between classes and things. But even if you're not a hardcore gamer, you can still grasp D&D. And, you know, over the years, it has really been sort of refined into a version. Like, I think that 5e is pretty easy to understand if you have any game playing knowledge. You know, you hear about young kids being taught Dungeons and Dragons. And then the appeal of stuff like Blades in the Dark, Powered by the Apocalypse, for me, is that it's so story driven. And because it's not focused so much on like math, equations, or even necessarily like the die roll isn't the standout thing in those games. It's what's appealing about those games to me is the narrative thrust. It's all about like these worlds and how the games are, the system is adaptable enough that you can play in just about any setting very easily. And then I got to the percentile games like Rifts, Palladium RPG, Nightbane, Heroes Unlimited, blah, 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 Ninjas and Super Spies.
Recon!
And I was like, what's the appeal here? And so basically all of this, all of my babbling is just looping back to exactly what you said, where it's like, everybody here, I'm finding all these threads in the palladiumbooks.com forums talking about how Glitter Boy Pilot is a stupid OCC, and in particular because it is just like specialized. There is a robot pilot OCC, so why not just do that and you'd be able to pilot a Glitter Boy? You know, what's the point of the hyper specific OCC? Well, Tom, I think you got it. That's the point of Rifts, right? Rifts is like a buffet.
Yeah, it's like the granularity. Tsimbita's like statted everything in the whole goddamn universe.
Yep. It's like going to one of those gigantic buffets in like Las Vegas where, you know, it's not great, but there's something for everyone here. You know, I don't go to the buffet expecting excellent Chinese food and excellent like diner food and excellent salads and anything like that. But there's so many options and they all meet like this baseline level of quality. So I think that must be the appeal, is just the sheer variety that this expansive system covers with its gazillion source books and world books and books of magic and stuff. But yeah, I guess all that to say, I'm pretty surprised at how much disdain there is for the Glitter Boy, just because in my mind it is like one of the most iconic classes in all of Rifts. It's right there from the start, and it really feels like, I don't know, even on the Rifts website, you see like animated GIFs of Glitter Boys and such. That said, though, I have to assume that the people posting in these forums are cranky diehard fans, because they also list a lot of things where they're talking about, like, worst books. They list some classic books that I was like, oh, really? Because I really liked that when I was younger. Like, Atlantis comes up a lot as one of the worst books. Juicer Uprising, I really liked that one when I was young. I remember a buddy of mine got Rifts Manhunter and thought it was the coolest thing. A lot of people seem to hate on Rifts Manhunter, so I don't know.
Do they say why they hate these books? Like, what is the reason for, like, why do people not like Atlantis?
They don't go into detail. They just think it's really silly.
What? Rifts? Silly? Absurd.
I don't like how so many parts of Atlantis weren't covered in favor of OCCs, bots, and equipment descriptions. I don't like how every conservator had a major rune weapon, or how rune statues seemed to be all over the place.
Okay, so
I used to really like Atlantis. Now it seems silly. I want to like Atlantis, but when I keep tripping over greatest ruin weapons that people have discarded in the streets, things have gotten out of hand.
Too powerful. I like it.
Apparently too powerful. Sure, it had some cool stuff. It felt very lacking, though, especially since we had so many years for additional information. Oh. Speaking of best and worst stuff in Palladium, though, Tom, I found a really funny thing that I had never heard of in one of these forums that was talking about the best and worst types of Rifts magic. And I discovered a type of Rifts magic that I'd never heard of. It's in the Rifts Book of Magic. I can even tell you it's on page 218 because I'm looking at it right now.
I know it's not ludicrous magic because I've brought that up on the podcast before.
It's not ludicrous magic. I feel like, I mean, people say this is a useless type of magic. And I would say that for the first number of levels, yeah, I don't think this would be particularly useful. It's from World Book 19, Mystic Russia. It's spoiling magic.
Okay.
One of the most impressive and terrible powers of the Night Witch is the ability to spoil. It is always a harmful magic transmitted through touch, pinch, kiss, or spell, as well as through enchanted food, drink, and objects such as goblets, glasses, spoons, and forks. Spoiling magic is just what it sounds like. Let me read you some level 1 spoiling magic spells. Curdle milk. Spoil eggs. Spoil wine. Here's a level 4 one. Cursed bread.
This just like breaking down like a couple of D&D spells into like a number of very specific uses. Like, oh, it's not just blight, it's curdle milk.
Well, exactly. And this is sort of negated by the fact that at level 5, the Night Witch OCC receives the spell spoil food.
Yeah, see, that's what... Yeah.
So we gotta go through several levels of getting the specific food. This it's the glitter boy all over again, but with food. Spells of spoiling food.
But I mean, this is what I'm saying is I think that's just what Rifts is just like making a specific thing for every freaking thing in the universe.
Spoil eggs. The Night Witch can rot fresh eggs, brackets any kind, still in their shell. Or eggs prepared for eating by touching them.
Now, man, you could fucking spoil dragon eggs?
Apparently you could spoil dragon eggs. Rot fresh eggs of any kind. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Spoil dragon eggs. What I find funny, though, is that eggs prepared for eating by touching them. Let me tell you, man. If I've got a plate of eggs and a witch comes over and just, like, sticks her hand in them... You don't have to cast a spoiling spell. I'm probably not going to eat them anymore. Spoil wine. In much the same way that the Night Witch can spoil milk by dipping her finger into the liquid or by staring at it for one full melee round, she can turn wine to vinegar. That doesn't even seem like... I mean, it's spoiled wine, but, like, vinegar can be useful.
Yeah, but you don't want to drink it the way you drink wine.
Tom, what are some things that you think a Night Witch can spoil that aren't food?
A relationship. Someone's mood.
Surprisingly, neither of those.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
The end of a movie.
Man, I wish there was spoil the end of a movie. Spoil sleep.
Okay.
Which, what do you think the effect of the spoil sleep spell is?
You, like, don't get a good night's rest?
Oh, it's far worse because it causes the bed to become infested with fleas, spiders, cockroaches, mice, and similar small but disgusting biting and squirming creatures. No matter what is done, the bed remains infested with the creatures, making sleep even in the same room impossible.
Man, this is like Everett Dangler has this power.
Dry mother's milk. By tying a knot in a milking animal's tail, that animal can no longer give milk until the knot is undone or cut out and a successful remove curse is performed. This magic can also afflict human mothers trying to breastfeed. The same basic process, but instead of tying a tail in a knot, the witch has to pinch the breasts. Come on, Rifts, grow up.
Ridiculous.
Go over and pinch your boob.
Got your milk.
Oh, boy. Here's something else that they can spoil. Your concentration.
Ooh, I like that.
The victim is easily distracted and not very alert or focused. Reduce skill performance by 10%, initiative by half, and -1 to melee attacks and actions. They can spoil your memory, which means you have trouble remembering things in general, or they can make you forget one small specific thing. Shoot, I forgot to pick up my clothes at the dry cleaners.
Oh, man.
My day is spoiled. Yeah, there's nothing here about spoiling a child. Weird. Spoil the mind with numbing madness. See, once you get past level 5, I feel like you actually start getting some useful ones. Spoiling someone's memory, spoiling their mind, spoiling their concentration. Fine. Level 5 is when you get impervious to disease and spoil food. And it just feels like that negates basically everything you get for the first 5 levels. I mean, I guess detect poison is useful, but the rest is like cursed bread. What do you think cursed bread does, Tom?
It makes a bread mushy on the inside.
No, it makes a bread that gives you indigestion.
Okay.
Those who eat the cursed bread suffer from bloating, stomach pain, and get 1d6 points of HP.
Do not eat of the cursed bread.
Spoil concentration, spoil memory, and then wither thy enemies, which is pretty cool. Makes its victim sick and waste away. It requires bits of the intended victim's hair or that person's footprint to cast harmful magic upon him. In the latter case, the witch gathers the soil around the footprint and puts it in a bag or pouch and attaches it to a tree or chimney. So, as I'm reading these, not only is the spoiling magic pretty silly, and, you know, like I just said, feels like everything before level 5 is kind of pointless anyway, but when you read up on what you gotta do in order to enact the spoiling magic, I'm having trouble imagining RPG scenarios where the players are actually doing this stuff, right?
It definitely implies a very specific type of story where you go around doing weird witch things rather than, you know, going around fighting orcs or something.
You gotta join. The Night Witch needs to join forces with a temporal wizard so that they can go back in time to when Hitler is a baby, and then the Night Witch can pinch Hitler's mom's boob to stop her producing milk. I don't know. Like you said, it seems like just such a specific, and like this whole thing where you gotta like gather the soil around a footprint. I have a hard time imagining one of my players being like, "Ooh, I want to curse that guy. Okay, where are his footprints?" And then I need to put it in a special pouch or bag and attach it to a chimney.
I could see you doing it in like a weird type of like World of Darkness game, but I don't know.
It's specific. This is all very specific. I guess the ultimate point, our ultimate point here is that specificity is core to Rifts.
I think it's important. Yeah.
It's definitely what sets it apart. I mean, even the use of the percentile die is like, we're going to get so specific. It's not like a 1 in 20 thing. It is 1 in 100. We are going to dial in on that exact result, whatever it may be.
I love it.
The highest level spell of the Night Witch is Demon Charms. These cursed charms are not pieces of jewelry, but utensils used in the preparation,
they're gonna
serving
take me Demon Charms.
Serving or eating of food and drink. So once again, the Night Witch has the power to enchant an object that has to be a fork, a spoon, a ladle, pot, pan, pitcher, goblet, glass, or other utensil cursed with spoilage. Any food it touches becomes magically but imperceptibly spoiled or poisoned.
Man, I want a cereal called Demon Charms.
Demon Charms. You're eating my Demon Charms.
Oh, man,
it's the opposite. It's not the
marshmallows.
Instead of a leprechaun trying to get his lucky charms, it's a demon trying to give away his Demon Charms. But this is another case where, like, the highest level spell of the Night Witch is being able to create, like, a cursed fork that spoils food that it touches. And all I can think is, like, it's just like a D&D magic item, right? Do you really need to, like, level up to max level in Night Witch OCC just to get an ability that could probably just be replaced by money? Like, you find a magic market and buy that? I don't know. A fork that spoils food doesn't seem all that powerful to me.
I don't know. It could be an interesting character.
It could be. But then you compare it with, like, you know, the next entry in this book is Stone Magic. And this is like, these guys are like earthbenders from Avatar The Last Airbender. It's just so much more powerful. Night Witch is over here, like, you're making a cow udder dry up, and then meanwhile the Stone Master OCC is like drawing powers from the very rock at his feet and able to, you know, conjure a freaking a pyramid. True Atlantean. I guess the Stone Masters are True Atlanteans, and they derive their power from giant pyramids of particular kinds of stone. Through that, they can gain powers like flight as the eagle, invulnerability, swim as the fish, invisibility, cure illness, fireball, shadow meld. So, would you rather be a stone master or a night witch?
I wonder if I can get a tattoo of some curdled milk, and then I could be a tea man that has night witch powers.
A tattooed man with a tattoo of spoiled milk and like a really rusty fork.
Yeah.
But Tom, you're going against your own philosophy here, because that would be a shortcut. That's like being a robot pilot OCC and learning how to pilot Glitter Boy armor. You shouldn't be a tattooed man OCC, or is it RCC? I think it's OCC. And then take the powers of the Night Witch. You got to be the Night Witch. The specificity, Tom, is what we're talking about here.
Okay. I'll do it. Be a creepy witch that spoils food.
Would you play a game of Rifts again? Like, it has been probably like 25 years since the last time I played Rifts. Would you play a game of Rifts again? When was the last time you played?
Man, yeah, I haven't played since probably Chaos Earth back in high school. But yeah, I'd play again. Why not? If someone's running it. Fuck.
But you would not run one yourself.
That would be a real undertaking. I would do it if I were like challenged to do it or something, but like if there's something on the line, yeah, I'd do it. I probably wish I was, I probably want to just like reskin a different system the whole time and just like play riffs, like riffs in the dark, you know?
Yeah, you'd snatch the setting and then and leave behind the clunky rules.
Although you'd lose a lot of the crazy character options with something like that. So, like, I don't know. Maybe, I don't know. It depends if the challenge is, like, run a riffs game or, you know, run a game based on riffs.
Here's a question for you, then. Here's another hypothetical, since we've blasted the Night Witch for all we can, I think. But here's a hypothetical, Tom. Can you envision a scenario where you would run a fantasy campaign using the Palladium RPG instead of D&D?
I mean, yeah, if I
So literally, if somebody was like, I dare you.
Yeah, kind of. If someone was like, if you came to me and you were like, Tom, I really want to try the Palladium Fantasy role-playing game, like, and you gave me like a time and whatever, and there were people who were interested, I'd be like, you know what? Okay, let's do it.
But you would never choose to.
I mean, I don't know. I've got some vague interest in it, but like, there's just so many games, you know? I think, yeah, if I'm trying to run the game that I most want to run, I think at best it's something that like incorporates aspects of the Palladium universe without actually being that game.
Yeah, and that's pretty much where I come down on it as well. And I don't know. It's not that I was feeling like philosophical about it. I guess I felt a degree of nostalgia for a time where like Rift was the game that I liked. Because the more I look at it now, having seen so many other systems, I find myself going like, is there room for this really? Like, are people still playing this? They must be.
Yeah, it's just like, I don't know. I can't imagine. When I imagine someone who's like really into the Palladium systems and stuff, like really like has opinions about whether or not the Glitter Boy is a good OCC or not, like I don't know if I get along with that person.
I guess another facet to my ponderance here is Palladium has been around for a long time. Palladium has been around basically my whole life. And yet, it feels like the one that is always left out of the conversation when people talk about RPGs. Like, people talk about Vampire the Masquerade. There was a freaking Vampire the Masquerade TV show, as briefly lived as it was. There's a new Vampire the Masquerade game that may have come out or it's coming out. I don't keep track of it, but like Vampire is still being talked about, more than the other World of Darkness games, but still there in the conversation. D&D is obviously extremely popular. And there are things like, Forged in the Dark that people are at least talking about because it's one of the newer ones. But through all of this, I just feel like nobody mentions Palladium. Nobody mentions Rifts. What's the deal with that? Where's Critical Role playing Rifts? Or where's the Adventure Zone playing Rifts?
Oh my god, yeah, that'd be quite the thing. That is actually a good question, is like, is there a Rifts live play out there or something?
There may be, but it's just not... I don't know. It's weird. Obviously, Rifts is popular. It has staying power enough that it's been around. God, I can't remember when it started, but like 30 years at least. And yet, it's just not in the conversation with those other ones.
Someone asked about someone posted about Rift's podcast on Reddit, and there's just a post that's like, you probably get hit with a cease and desist. Classic Palladium.
Third printing for the... Okay, so copyright is 1983. It's as old as I am. Rifts is 40 years old. And yet, I don't see it out there. I don't see anybody talking about it. It's never in the conversation. Really, I don't know. If going purely by the generic, you know, like r/RPG on Reddit, like the forums that are talking about the broad strokes of RPGs, I feel like there are probably more threads within the past few years on Nobilis than there are on Rifts even.
It does seem like an untapped opportunity, but I do wonder if maybe...
Let's not be so hasty. I don't know if it's an opportunity. It's really just that I'm surprised that something that has gone on for so long, and I don't know, maybe I'm just biased because it was the first RPG I was introduced to, but it feels like it's pretty expansive. Like, it feels like it should be known, given the amount of shelf space it took up at, like, Fandom 2.
Yeah, McGill, if you told me, Tom, there's no Rifts live plays out there, we got to corner the market and have the one that everybody comes to when they look up Rifts, I'd do that. That sounds exciting.
Oh my God. Are you proposing we do this?
I don't know. It seems like a lot of work. We've already got a
From
podcast.
Now on, Comparing Campaign is a Rifts live play podcast. Tom has volunteered to be the GM. Tell me, Tom, which world book are we starting with?
Oh man, probably Core, or maybe, I don't know. Actually, you know what? Probably Mechanoid Trilogy, Mechanoid Invasion Trilogy.
Yeah, okay, here we go. So
all the way to back to the beginnings.
Mechanoid Trilogy. Neat. Oh man.
Now you got me
curious. I want to know if there are Rifts.
Start as colonists on Gideon Prime, and then within three acts you'll be fucking aliens, not fucking aliens, but you'll be aliens in a crazy interstellar society, and then we'll bring the Rifts in and I'll be all nonsense. You know, I always get this, it doesn't always make sense, but I always get this vibe that's like, when you say like, what do we start with, I'm like, well, the first one. And then from there, we'll do every other one, which is like, you know, you can't actually do that. Like, you can't be playing New World of Darkness and then be like, okay, now I'm going to do vampire. Okay, now I'm going to do werewolf. It's like, no, you did vampire, so now you can't be werewolf. And like, so Rifts is kind of the same thing. Like, as much as I want to just have an ongoing thing where like, you know, I just keep throwing in every world book like it's DLC over and over again. But like, you know, really, the narrative can only cover so much.
Man, so I'm doing some searching. Other people are wondering, as we are, about Rift's actual play podcasts. And you know, I think I found that Reddit thread that you were talking about. I've just gotten into the Critical Role podcast.
Yeah,
I never
played
D&D growing up, just Rifts. Is there a similar podcast for Rifts? And the answer is like pretty resoundingly no.
Then that one guy being like, they probably get a C&D.
Yeah. Well, what's funny is I went to rifts.fandom.com, the Rifts wiki there, and there is a section for podcasts. And there's TalkShoe Gateway to the Megaverse, an online interactive chat about the various goings-on at Palladium Books. So this is not a actual play podcast. This is actually like Palladium Books news. The last episode was on June 11th, 2012.
Classic Palladium.
I might have to listen to this one. Echoes from the Rifts. Have you heard of this? an auditory experience that takes fans into the world of Palladium Books. Fans new and old of the Megaverse and its many worlds will have the chance to hear them from the man himself, Kevin Ciambita.
When was the last episode of that?
June 6th, 2009.
Yeah.
It made it to 16 episodes. Wow. Announced that it's on hiatus for the foreseeable future.
If I thought there was an opportunity in it, I'd seize on that opportunity and do the Rifts podcast, but I don't know.
There is, though, Tom, because these podcasts that are on the Rifts wiki, none of them are actual play. The next two are Gamers Haven and RPG Circus, and both of them are doing what we do with the RPG Danger Room. Gamers Haven has an episode on Beyond the Supernatural, an episode on Ninjas and Super Spies, Nightbane and Heroes Unlimited, and then the RPG Circus just talks about Palladium books in general. And it seems like the only actual play podcast out there, I think it's even just a one shot, I don't think it's actually ongoing, is this guy who adapted the plot of a dumb movie called The Eliminators, which I've seen, and made it into a Rifts game and made his players play it for 2 hours.
I mean, it just seems like a lot of work is the thing. We've already got a podcast. I need to have some promise that this podcast project is going to take off, you know?
What do we do when you catch up to the present with your game, obviously? We just got to play some Rifts.
Maybe. We'll need more players.
You know what's funny is...
at least one more person.
So, the 12th result, searching for Rifts actual play podcast. The 12th result is a City of Mist podcast.
Ooh, wow. Oh, yeah, because they're Rifts.
Yeah, the Rift of Hermes is one of the characters. Man, that's really funny.
Well, is that it for the episode?
I think it is. We ended on a note I didn't intend to, though, and now I'm going to have to do some research and see why is Rifts not in the RPG conversation with the other big names like Dungeons and Dragons, World of Darkness.
Yeah, it's true. Maybe because those other games are just better. If you want to get in touch with us, see when we post new episodes or follow us, check us out on Facebook, Comparing Campaign on Facebook. If you want to check out our show notes and supplemental materials, check us out on comparingcampaign.wordpress.com. Who knows why they don't play Rifts anymore? Not me.
Level up, get that Rifts actual play podcast. Actually, if you're listening to this and you know of a Rifts actual play podcast that is ongoing, please send us a link. I'm so curious.
Yeah, I'd be curious too. Take care, everybody.